Word on Today FM.
It's time for the Culture Club, but before we meet our guest, let's hear a piece of music which will identify him straight away. Mark McCabe, you're very welcome to the Culture Club.
Thank you very much.
25th anniversary edition of Maniac 2000.
Yeah.
So tell us, what changes have you made?
To my life or?
No, to Maniac 2000.
Well, there's a new vocal. So eagle-eyed listeners will have noticed that the female vocal is Mimi Lane on the new version. And it's much the same. I mean, there was no point trying to reinvent the wheel, as they say. It was just a case of trying to sort of reproduce with a little bit more experience because when we initially recorded the track, we had no idea what we were doing technically or musically.
So why did you do it?
25 years ago or it was something to do, to be honest with you. I had finished with a pirate station called Pulse FM. We went off air. The license we applied for went to Spin and I was in this sort of transition stage being 19 years of age and not much to do. And Billy from Abbey Discs knew that there was a market for this track because people had been coming into his shop and asking for it. And he said, would you, you know, consider releasing it? And we said, okay. So we set about producing a new backing track and going to the cricket club in Clontarf and recording it and just something to do, to be honest with you.
And then 25 years on, why re-record it now?
It kind of felt like it was... So the track hasn't been on streaming platforms and it never really transcended from the physical world of CD and cassette. There are versions out there, but it was never continued, shall we say. So it always remained somewhat underground or available through YouTube versions that people had put up or whatever. So there's just been this huge call for it to be available on Spotify in particular. There's a petition online that has been there for 5 or 10 years. I get messages weekly from people saying, please put it up. You know, I've got my hen party or I've got a wedding or I've got a house party or something. So we just figured if there was ever a year to do it, this is the year.
Are you comfortable with it now? Because I was reading that there might have been a period in your life where you perhaps wanted to sort of step away from being associated with the track.
Definitely. When the track was released, after the first 6 months, I have been quoted as saying, it's going to take me 5 years to remove myself from this, to move on from it, because there was such a reaction to it at the time. That then went to 10 years. It then went to, you know, I'm never going to get over this. And I did struggle because I wanted to try and create a career in the music industry. And I was producing and I was learning how to produce and I was working for people and I was recording bands and orchestras and nothing could ever get me beyond it. It was always, oh, that I really love what you've done with Gavin James.
It was defining you to an extent,
totally, totally. And it has, you know, it is to this day.
But no, you've embraced
but
it.
But I've embraced it. And, you know, I had that landmark moment at the Electric Picnic in 2015 when I performed it again for the first time after 10 years, kind of just washing my hands of it. And I just had a totally different outlook as to what it was and what it meant, because I grew up, you know, when the track was released, it was a very different time. Musically, it was a very different time. And I was competing over the years, you know, between 2000 and 2005 with the likes of Bellex One or Juniper or, you know, all of these sort of, you know, big Irish bands. And this just wasn't taken seriously. This was just, you know, a novelty track that, you know,
Has endured
for a long time. And I think that's kind of, no matter what you, I remember, you know, I met a lot of sort of famous and established people. And when I tried to speak to them about it, I was always quite embarrassed because they were where they were, and this was what my contribution to the music industry was. And they said, listen, don't be embarrassed about it. You did it. You know, no matter what anybody says, you did it.
Well, let's talk through your culture club choices, because that shows where your love of music comes from and all the things you're interested in. First single that you can remember, what did you buy?
So it was The Prodigy and Charlie, and it was on cassette, and it was a track that just sounded so different to everything that was around at the time. And it really was the sort of landmark moment for me in dance music and sort of embracing what dance music was about to become. And it wasn't really dance music, because the Prodigy have always been in their own lane. It just stood out to me, and it just absolutely screamed at me because it was so different to everything else that was around at the time.
Let's hear a bit of Charlie. Prodigy and Charlie. What do you think of it now?
It's funny when you listen back to stuff. And some things age well, some things don't particularly age well. I don't think that track of all of theirs has managed to endure as much as some of the other ones, like Firestarter or stuff like that. But it's that sample. They sampled something, and it was kind of my first realization of what sampling was. You know, that little vocal hook is taken from something completely different. What were we thinking at the time?
Okay, favourite album. I know for somebody involved in music, this is really difficult to make you go to plump for one particular album. But you have picked a particularly good album, a classic from the 90s, The Bends by Radiohead.
Yeah.
Why'd you go for that? Because a lot of people, when they go for Radiohead, go for the more 21st century stuff.
Yeah.
Or OK Computer.
Yeah.
If they're going to go back to the 20th century.
And I never understand that, because I always speak to people, you know, if I'm talking about this, and they're like, but no, OK Computer was absolutely their best album. And it's like, not for me. For me, you know, my favourite album has to be something that's more than just a couple of tracks. It has to be something that once you start, you want to go to the end. And for me, The Bends is one of those albums that it's just track after track after track. It just gets better and better and better. And for me, it was just Radiohead in their absolute, you know, peak. But a really, really difficult question to answer, because there are so many. But, you know, Alanis Morissette, Jagged Little Pill is another one of those albums that I feel I can put on and listen to from start to finish. And it's just every track is just, there's no skipping, there's no filler track. It's just absolute sort of, you know, they're in the peak of their career. And that one for me, just sonically, everything about it, the meaning behind the songs, the depth of his, you know, his connection to what he's talking about and what he's singing about is just A1, top class.
Let's hear from The Bends, High and Dry.
You'll be the one who cannot talk. All your insides fall to pieces. You just sit there wishing you could still make love. They're the ones who hate you when you think you got the world all so stacked. Don't leave me.
The wonderful Radiohead, High and Dry from the Bends. And I love the point you make about it. There's a dozen tracks on it. Finally, the final track would be my favourite on the album, Street Spirit, which is just leaves you going out on a high. I think it's a fantastic album altogether.
Yeah.
And great choice.
It's one of those albums that people go, oh, it's such a drain. He's so boring. And, you know, it's just, why would you want to listen to that? And it's kind of like, well, do you not understand that, you know, you're hearing that emotion so you don't have to almost, you know, he's the one who's upset and and sort of completely at odds with the world. And
it's
beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And it allows you to experience that kind of hurt without having to experience that kind of hurt, if that makes sense.
Okay. Favorite band or artist? You've given us a few that I hadn't expected. So tell us about why you've picked the likes of Steely Dan, Bob Seger and Swedish House Mafia.
Yeah. So again, I've grown up always wanting to be in the music industry. That was all I ever wanted.
Why?
I was just absolutely fascinated with everything to do with it. Staging, lighting, sound, production, everything about that whole industry just completely fascinated me. And I grew up... my dad was the dean of Christchurch.
Oh.
That's where he ended his career.
Where they would have had choirs singing, presumably, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, I had that sort of backstage at church experience where you would see the sort of logistics of how a church runs. But you would also, you know, I got to play the organ in the church. I got to listen to choirs rehearsing, and the Christchurch choir is, you know, phenomenal. But then I was working in music shops after school on a Wednesday or at the weekends. And that's really where the sort of Steely Dan, Bob Seger thing comes from. There was a guy called Colm who worked in Rocksteady Music, which was a shop that I used to hang around in. And he would always be playing these tunes downstairs. You know, he was a really good player himself. And Steely Dan and Bob Seger were two albums that he just constantly had on repeat for people when they were in the shop or whatever. And I just really enjoyed it. And I discovered this album called The Rock and Soul Review, which was Donald Fagen and a bunch of his, you know, muso friends. And it is the most incredible album to listen to. It's like just the best of the best session musicians from America, New York at that time. And I just fell in love with Steely Dan and that sound and Bob Seger. But then on the other side of things, as I was growing up, the rave culture was, you know, evolving. Dance music was becoming more successful and commercial. And I loved that, you know, Swedish House Mafia, Fatboy Slim, The Prodigy, all of that stuff as well. So it was a weird time for me growing up because we were transitioning from Oasis and Blur and the rock and roll years into you're either a rocker or a raver. And I kind of wanted to be both because I grew up playing drums, played in bands, mixed live sound for bands, stuff like that, but also was interested in DJing. Ultimately, that's where I've ended up. But along the way, I've had a really sort of varied career with the people that I've worked with or recorded or stuff like that, you know. And it's just all music. Ultimately, that's what it comes down to.
Let's hear a little bit of Steely Dan, possibly the most famous track, Reeling in the Years. Dan, Reeling in the Years. Now, best gig you've ever been at, Mark McCabe. You've given us a couple. Before we go to the second one and play a clip from it, why have you picked Michael Jackson, The Dangerous Tour? When was that?
Oh, probably 90s anyway, mid-90s probably.
Okay.
It was the show that he left the stadium with a rocket pack. So he strapped a rocket pack to his back and flew up into the air. And
was that here in Dublin?
It was in Lansdowne Road. Okay. Yeah, yeah. And it was just incredible. And it was, you know, the Dangerous Tour. So it was that album. And there's some really great tracks on that album. And, you know, it was Michael Jackson in his peak, as far as I'm concerned. And it was just an absolutely phenomenal gig. Really enjoyed it.
And then another one you have is U2. And I'm sure Bono would love to have left many gigs with a rocket attached to his back for the showmanship. You've gone for part of the Zoropa tour.
Yeah. So that was kind of my awakening of music production. And that was one of the first kind of shows where screens started to become, you know, part of the staging. And they had the Trabants,
the East German cars.
Yeah, so they had them suspended from the stage. So it was a guy called Willie Williams was the designer. He was their lighting guy. And from that moment on, I was just like, this is the industry I want to be in. And that show from start to finish, it's available on DVD. If you haven't watched it, it's just another one of those wow moments.
But it's quite clear from all the things you're saying, what you love is the entire production, isn't it? It just can't be the music on its own. You need more than that.
For sure, yeah. I mean, that's how live music has gone. And, you know, everybody strives to put on as big a show as possible. But, I mean, when you're at that point, even with Michael Jackson, the songs are just so good.
They have to be good in the first place, but you have to have the support around them. Let's hear a bit of U2 from the Zoropa tour. Stay. From U2 from the Zoropa tour, I think it was 1993.
Yeah, that was, I mean, you were hearing, you know, Where the Streets Have No Name, but you were also hearing Bullet the Blue Sky and stuff like that. But then they started to bring in all of this kind of, there was a satellite connection with, you know, Lou Reed, I think, yeah. Now, whether it was actually live or not, I don't know, but he used to make phone calls as well to the French
world
president
leaders.
And world leaders and all of that. But it was the first time that somebody had started to sort of, you know, there was outward communication from the event and inward communication. And the technical at that time was just mind-blowing. It was just like, wow. So you had all of these massive songs.
It was like Zoom calls 32 years basically. Ago on stage.
Yeah, basically. Which was incredible and totally unheard of. And they were the first really to do that kind of, you know, apart from Pink Floyd, maybe with The Wall, they were the first kind of commercial band, you know, to do that kind of staging and to put on that kind of show.
Okay, we need to take a break. Mark McCabe is with us because it's 25 years since the initial version of Maniac 2000 became such a cult classic. In fact, it wasn't a cult classic. It became a nationwide anthem almost. And the 25th anniversary edition is out now. We'll be back with more of Mark's choices after this break. Welcome back. Mark McCabe is with us for the Culture Club as we're marking the 25th anniversary edition of Maniac 2000. Okay, let's move away from the music and let's go to movies. So we asked you for movies, actors, directors. Tell us about some of the people that you have picked out for us.
This was another really tough one. And I did realise that I was slightly gender biased with the list that I started with, but
you've gone for all the lads.
Yeah, there's a lot of that, yeah. And that's probably just because I'm just not sort of thinking deeper as to who might be there. But like Quentin Tarantino, he's the kind of, like, I don't even need to know anything about the movie. I'm perfectly prepared to go and sit and just watch what he's done because he's, you know, his the way that he's compiled movies and the little tricks that he has and the quirks that he has, it's just really enjoyable to watch, even if the movie isn't that good. I just really enjoy his directing style. Leonardo DiCaprio, all of his movies growing up, I just really loved, and he was a really solid actor, and very believable in everything that he played. Julia Roberts, I just really loved her in Pretty Woman, but then she went on to do, you know, a couple of other movies, and she was always a really solid and believable actor again. And somebody who I just thought, you know, you believe.
Even as Katie Kiernan and Michael Collins.
Well, yeah, well, you know, they can't all be great. but Johnny Depp, Al Pacino.
She was brilliant in Erin Brockovich, which she won the Oscar
for. She
was,
for, yeah. Yeah, yeah. Just a really, you know, a believable actor. When you can sort of watch somebody year after year in movie after movie and still not see them as being, you know, that one person in that one film, when they manage to sort of inject themselves into movies and really become the character.
We have a scene from one of the Tarantino movies, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And this is a scene in which Bruce Lee, played by Mike Moe, and stuntman Cliff Booth, played by Brad Pitt, come together.
Well, if you fought Cassius Clay, who would win?
Well, that would never happen.
But if you did, what do you think would happen?
I'd make him a cripple.
Hey, you. What's your name?
Me?
Yeah, you.
My name's Cliff. I'm Rick Dalton's stunt double.
Stuntman?
Yeah.
You know, you're kind of pretty for a stuntman.
That's what they tell me.
So, did I say something funny, stuntman?
Yeah, you kind of did.
What's so funny?
Look, man, I don't want any trouble. I'm just here to do a job.
But you're laughing at what I'm saying. But I'm not saying anything funny. So what do you think is so funny?
What I think is, you're a little man with a big mouth and a big chip. And I think you should be embarrassed to suggest you'd be anything more than a stain on the seat of Cassius Clay's trunks.
Brother, you're the one with the big mouth. And I would really enjoy closing it, especially in front of all my friends. But my hands are registered as lethal weapons. That means we get into a fight, I accidentally kill you, I go to jail.
Anybody accidentally kills anybody in a fight, they go to jail. It's called manslaughter. And I think all that lethal weapon horse shit is just an excuse so you dancers never have to get in a real fight.
Great scene.
That was a great movie.
Yes.
And Brad Pitt is probably one of my favorites as well. He kind of had a lull. There was a movie that he did which was kind of Gladiator-esque. I can't remember the name of it, but it was it Troy or something like that?
Was that the one Colin Farrell was in as well?
Possibly, yeah. But he went through this period where it was just like, no, what's happened here? But he's come back around again and he's starring in some movies that are really great. He's in a movie with George Clooney, and it's Brad Pitt and George Clooney, and they're two hired hitmen. And it's them, you know, at the age that they're at and, you know, just enjoying life, making a movie together. You can see that they're really enjoying it, but their chemistry on screen and the movie itself is really good. I can't remember the name of it, but.
Okay. We asked you for a favorite play, theatre show or musical, and it turns out you spend a lot of time working with schools in musical production.
Yeah. Yeah.
How so, and how difficult is that?
I've recently just finished a production of a 90s thing, and it was, It was great fun, let's just say.
What age are the school children you're working with?
Transition year.
Okay.
So what I do is I try and teach how to use audiovisual equipment so that they can run events in the school themselves. So it's in Wesley College in Dublin, the school that I went to, that I've had a great relationship. I didn't do my Leaving Cert, I left. I went straight into the workforce as such, doing live sound and stage. And I've always had a really good relationship with them. And they were really happy to have me back to try and sort of, you know, foster some kind of opportunity for people who were similar to me, that, you know, not everybody is fit for the Leaving, not everybody's fit for, you know, secondary college and so on. So it's great to be there, and it's really enjoyable, and the kids are great, and the talent is just unreal. You know, the songs they sing, the way they sing them, and some of them just go on and do college courses and never, you know, go back to that. They never become an artist or a singer.
But they've had the experience. But they've had the experience and the joy of it.
And they've had the joy of it, yeah. And it's an absolute pleasure to go in once a week and just take, you know, an hour and a bit and show them how to use the equipment and try and make them sound good when they go on the stage in the school.
So what sort of productions would you have on your list?
Personally? Or,
yeah, personally.
Or that we've done?
Yeah.
Blood Brothers was always a show that I loved, mostly musicals. I worked on, it was a show that was in the Olympia Theatre and it was to do with Johnny Valens and Buddy Holly. It was the Buddy Holly story and I was part of the crew for that. And I thought that, you know, that's what I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to be involved with theatre sound and stuff like that, but I never actually made it there. But any of those sort of classic shows like West Side Story or Joseph and His Amazing Technicolor, Dreamcoat or Grease, if they're done properly and the leads are, you know, able to sing the songs in the way they should be sung, I love them. I think they're great.
Let's hear a bit of Grease. And this is from a London cast recording, Craig McLachlan and Debbie Gibson singing Summer Nights.
Yeah.
I'm old enough to remember when that was a hit for John Travolta and Olivia Newton-John.
I was going to say by comparison, that's awful. It's a tough act to get those. That's what I mean by, you know, if they sing them properly, if they get the, I don't know, the purpose and the meaning of the way that they were sung by John Travolta and Olivia. When you get it right, it's wonderful. But if you do that West End thing to it, they just become a little bit sort of dry and meaningless like that.
Okay, you've got your standards. You got
definitely,
your standards. Okay.
Definitely.
Okay, television. Okay, let's go to television. And I understand you love reality TV.
Yeah. So Discovery or Quest or any of the boys channels. So any of the, like the shed programs, the repair shed, where they take, you know, old antique things. They can be gramophones or, you know, an old book that's bound in leather or something like that. And they, you know, they bring them back to life and they do it in the real traditional way as to how it would have been done, you know, way back. And it just fascinates me to see. I went through a period where I was restoring vintage audio equipment. So there was a lot of equipment that was released and produced in the 70s and 80s by a guy called Rupert Neave. And this Neave sound is what created the sound that we hear in the likes of Steely Dan or Fleetwood Mac. It's this particular console that was used that gives it that sound. And you'll hear it particularly in the drums and toms. Like the Carpenters would be a perfect example of that kind of sound. And his mentality was that there was something more going on with, you know, how things are recorded that we can't hear or perceive. And it goes into what MP3s are and what we've taken out and how that affects you when you listen to it and why it's different to listen to a record through an analog system versus listening to, you know, Spotify on your phone. You're missing certain frequencies and those frequencies are perhaps affecting you beyond what you can actually orally perceive.
Okay.
So it's waves that are coming at you and what is being perceived by your brain and your body. So Rupert Neave was the genius behind all of this. So I loved sort of taking old redundant equipment of his and turning it into something that could be usable in the studio. And I actually built a studio that was based, you know, predominantly on vintage equipment in the early noughties, which was the opposite direction to everybody else. You know, they were just looking at a laptop and a box.
Yeah.
And let's just get this recorded, you know, so... but that's kind of always been in me. And anything like Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares or Deadliest Catch. For some reason, I can watch episode after episode of Deadliest Catch, and it's the same thing pretty much. They go out in the boat and they fish and they come back, but it's just really compelling viewing. And I don't know whether it's just because it's so far from, you know, the world that I know, it just really, really appeals to me. And then when it goes into series, things like Better Call Saul, he's just a phenomenal actor. I can't think of his
Bob
name.
Bob
Odenkirk.
Actually, let's hear a little bit of Bob Odenkirk playing Jimmy McGill or Saul Goodman, and Nacho played by Michael Mando in a scene from Better Call Saul.
Somebody told those people to go camping. Somebody warned them.
They're very woodsy. And between you and me, they're pretty rash when it comes to the decision making. They're not really the plan ahead types.
Yeah, I'd cut the cute attitude right about now if I were you.
You ratted on me. There will be consequences.
Hey, if somebody warned the Kettlemans, it was probably somebody who was worried about those kids.
You know how much trouble you caused me?
Hey, you didn't need any help getting caught, okay? The neighbor ID'd you. You were sloppy. Any trouble you might have, that's on you. Not to mention the blood in your van. Here's a thought. Ajax, Formula 409. You have no idea the tap dance I had to give those cops to get you out of here. You gave them probable cause out the wazoo. Now, and whoever somebody is who may have warned the Kettlemans got them out of there before you did anything even more stupid. You should be thanking this good Samaritan, because whoever he is, he did you a favor.
I think I must go back and watch Better Call Saul again, start to finish.
Yeah. He's a classic actor. He really is brilliant. And I wish they would do another series. I'm not sure whether it's ever going to happen, but I really, really enjoyed it almost as much as I did Breaking Bad.
And how they merged was brilliant as well. Just to finish off, though, I see when we asked you this question, you say you now watch more YouTube than you do television or even Netflix.
Yeah. So people like Matt Armstrong, he's just a guy in the UK, and he restored an Audi TT in his front garden. And he's now got a warehouse and he's restoring supercars, and, you know, they're worth 2.5 million, you know, and I've watched him from the beginning, and I've watched him grow, and I've watched the channel grow, and it's just really fascinating viewing. Or somebody like Baldwin Bankrupt, he goes off around Europe and shows you places that, you know, you would never see, from Russia into, you know, Asia and places like that.
What's it called? Baldwin Bankrupt?
Baldwin Bankrupt is his name. Yeah, he's a quirky guy. He got arrested in Russia, actually, because he was accused of spreading propaganda against the state. But just really interesting channels out there of people that are out living their lives and doing things that you and I probably will never, ever do. And you get like a weekly sort of 30-minute, 40-minute episode of something. And it's just fascinating. I think it's great.
That's a great way to finish. Mark McCabe, it's been great having you. Congratulations on the 25th anniversary edition of Maniac 2000.
The Last Word on Today FM.